And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Vahan Setyan about Armenia, the people, the history, the origins of Indo-Europeans or Indo-Aryans, if you prefer that term, which I do. And a very interesting conversation here about the cross, cultural correlations and origin points in history and everything else, and of course the language in itself. But let's talk a little bit more now about the actual suppression of the Armenian people, the genocide, the Holocausts that you guys have gone through in the last 100 plus years here, and, mm-hmm. And what some of the incentives or the reasoning behind this, basically. I mean, we have the issue of the Ottoman Empire, but there's a lot of geopolitical things that goes on behind the surface here, or behind the scenes, if it's, as it were. Tell us what we should know first of all about the main event, 1915. What happened and why?
Well, it's pretty complicated, and actually it was a good thing that you mentioned geopolitical reasons, because it was not really Islam that was the reasoning behind the extermination of the Armenian people. You had also Greeks and Assyrians who were massacred by the Ottoman Empire at that time. But the Armenian people saw the biggest blow on the genocide. They were basically trying to completely uproot those people from those lands. And 1.5 million passed away. They were killed. And even 50 years before that, during the Abdul Hamid times, a lot of Armenians were killed, at least 300,000-400,000 people. So, if you are there and you have plundered through all those lands and you want to take those lands as yours, you want to get rid of all those people out of there. You want to make the world know that, you were there before them. And because of that, most Armenians were killed, and they were killed in a very atrocious way. I mean, you had, babies that were beheaded, and you had pregnant women, their bellies opened, and children being opened from their wounds. You had children who had sand in their throats until they suffocated. So it was pretty bad, and we have all these records, and we're trying to let them understand their past, to get reconciled with the past, and the entire international community is trying to make this known so nothing like this would ever happen. Because if you're going to deny the Armenian genocide, we are going to see further atrocities elsewhere in the world. So the acceptance of the Armenian genocide is not really just for Armenians, it's for the entire world population to make sure that nothing would happen, but it continues to happen. Throughout the world, we saw that in China, in Cambodia, and so forth, Uganda, and so forth. You see all these things happening. It's just because the world has to really understand, the atrocities that took place at that time, which was the first genocide, of course, happened in the 20th century, which followed, during the Hitler times in 1930s and 1940s. So. We have to look at it from that standpoint, that the initial initiative was for them to uproot the Armenian people from their ancestral lands and then incorporate those lands into their own. Because they would say, okay, well, now we're here. And then at the same time, this is the other problem. And I think the world should know. After the Armenian history started being falsified from the early 20s until now, they always say that the Armenian people came from elsewhere around 600 BC. Mm. They came from the Balkans and so forth. And there is no evidence of that at all. All the genetics and archaeology and archaeogenetics prove that the Armenian people are inhabitants of those lands for thousands of years. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to, through historical falsifications, to uproot those people out of there. So now they would say, okay, if you came in at that time, we are doing the same thing. So what's the difference? So as you can see, that because of that, they're barring the Armenian people from their ancestor homeland. In other words, they're trying to say, okay, well, these are not your lands, so don't even ask for them.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And you mentioned that before as well, the Hamidan massacres. That was a lot of people murdered, killed there as well. I think it's estimated from anywhere from 80,000 to 300,000. And then later on, you have the Armenian genocide in 1915, thereabouts. Yes. So this has been a long, ongoing issue and quest, and of course, by the Ottoman Empire. You had forces behind the scenes as well. The Young Turks and some people have been going in and looking at some of the incentives and motives of some of these people. How much have you looked into that, and why, you know, who actually pulled the strings behind this?
Well, you know, I'm not into politics too much, but what I know from my research, for example, Susan Armstrong in The History of God, she wrote that the Young Turks, the initiators of Young Turks, were the Donme, who were Jews. So those the instigators, basically the head people, were not Turkish at all, and we see through the evidence that they were not. So you have that also into play. I haven't delved too much into that situation, but at the same time, you know, we can say that, you know, the Turkish people were liable for all these atrocities. There had to be another force. I mean, you have to consider other possibilities. For example, Christopher Jon Bjerknes.
Oh yeah, definitely great stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, he wrote about this in great length, thousands of pages. You know, it talks about how the geopolitical situation was not solely Turkish. So we have to take into this consideration. We want to know why. The reasoning behind it. And the thing is, if we look at history, we can see that there was a migration of, let's say, Jews into Turkey. And then Jews, let's say, from Spain into other parts of the world. Christopher Columbus was a Jew. So you can see the migration, you know, from where they were persecuted, and now they're trying to find other places to call themselves the homeland. And, you know, they were asked, okay, you know, either we kill you, or you become a Muslim. So they will say, okay, fine, we'll do that. But, you know, internally, they would practice their own faith. So through that, you can see the connectedness between the Young Turks and the Jews from Spain and so forth.
Well, it's very interesting, a converso, as they call it, or a crypto-Jew in some cases. And again, this is like, I mean, if we look at the Ottoman Empire and what was going on at that time, I want to try to put this actually a little bit in context of what we're seeing even today, actually, which is interesting. But for example, look at the mechanics of the slave trade out of Africa to the British and later American colonies. The mm-hmm. Arabs had a tremendous infrastructure in place here mm-hmm. from the North African countries. Of course, you had African tribal kings themselves that actually captured other tribes, other sure. black people, and sold them to the Arabs, and then you had Jews who basically owned the slave ships that carried a lot of the Jews over. This mm-hmm. is like something that, point being here, everyone was involved in this kind of behavior. Slaves has been a tradition in human history more than for a longer period than it hasn't been, right? So,
well, yeah, I mean, slavery is condoned in the Bible. You know, it allows sure, people yeah. to have slaves. So,
and the point there being then that, you know, we can see, I guess I want to try to get a little closer to the stance on a country like Turkey, for example, today, where basically all the blame for colonialism and everything else has basically been put on European peoples and European countries and everything else, when it's obvious that this is something that was a standard in all the countries in the world. We've always fought for resources, we've always fought for territory and sure. and you know, warred with other people and whatnot. And I just find it interesting that there seems to be a kind of a leniency on the history on the Ottoman Empire in this case, and mm-hmm. Turkey specifically. So it's almost yeah. like what we are seeing happening in Europe right now is not something at all that's being, you know, put on the Turkish people, for example. And in this case, then, when we talk about the Armenian Holocaust, has mm-hmm. there been, as far as you're concerned, like a non-recognition from the part of Turkey here? Are they trying to deny it, or are they admitting to it? And you know, are they pay? I mean, if we look at other Holocausts, there are reparations being paid, etc. Is there a similar scenario in your case?
Of course. I mean, they are denying until today. They're saying it never happened. They're saying that, you know, both sides saw similar casualties, you know, in that context. You know, they're not talking about the atrocious, you know, planned extermination of people. And but they are blaming it on the Ottoman Empire, saying it was them, it wasn't us, and so forth. So there is denial, of course. You know, they say it never happened. I mean, we have pictures from everywhere. You know, we even have attestations from the president of the United States at that time and so forth. You know, we have all this data, and it's still the denial is taking place, and for obvious reasons. Can you imagine the repercussions of that once they accept the Holocaust or genocide.
Yeah.
The lands and the tons of gold that was taken from the Armenian people at that time that amassed into trillions of dollars. So we have big issues to resolve even after the acceptance takes place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely horrible. And again, the one-sidedness here. Now, is there a specific other reason? I mean, if we talk about origins, if we talk about a rich, interesting history, a language connection, is there any kind of other reasoning behind the planned extermination of the Armenian people? There's something that they really do not want to come, they don't want this to come out and be known for some reason. Is that how you interpret this?
I mean, various elements come into play when, some people deny their ancestral past or even whatever transpired 100 years ago. I mean, you're talking about being on the lands of those people, first of all. In other words, their culture and their language, for instance, has been influenced by the Armenians. The Armenian people were actually the ones that sewed their uniforms before the genocide, the Turkish army. They were part of the banking system. You know, they were part of the infrastructure, the architecture. The entire architecture in Turkey was basically built by the Armenian people. So you have all these contributions by the very people that you want to exterminate. So if you're going to exterminate, you really want to exterminate them well, so the memory would not stay. And you're talking about not just language influence, you know, we're talking about culture, and we're talking about ancient history and the plunders that took place 600 years ago into those lands.
Right. Yeah.
So everything is into play, really. I mean, but just by accepting the Armenian genocide, you know, you are showing the world first that, you know, you're more humble, which is important. And then two, you know, you can say, okay, these people were living here for a very long time and we took those lands. Yes, it was in the past. Now, can we reconcile our differences? It's important.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about basically stances on potential animosity between Jews and Armenians or Muslims and Armenians. I mean, if there was a targeting of Orthodox or Armenian Christians, for example. I mean, I read, and this is going to be controversial, but, you know, whatever. I read in the April 1998, I think it was Igor Muradian, I think it's
Muradian,
pronounced.
Yes.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
An Armenian political analyst and economist. And I actually published an article in one of Armenia's leading newspapers, Voice of Armenia, and he claimed that the history of the Armenian Jewish relations had been filled with what he quotes as Aryans versus Semites as a conflict of manifestation. I guess if we look at it from an historical point of view and take his assumptions into account, is there any validity to anything like this? Is there anything like this that's been going on? And if Armenia is some kind of ancient origin point, is there a religious and an ethno-based warfare that is attributed to the conflicts between Aryans versus Semites? Is there any truth to an argument like that?
Well, actually, your question is very, very important. And I would say I wouldn't put too much emphasis on his writings as opposed to the concept itself. And the concept actually goes back thousands of years. And if you're talking about the Armenian Highland, for instance, being the origin of either languages and Esoteric theology, you can see that's how other people have tried to connect themselves to those lands, connect themselves as them being the original inhabitants. If you look at the Old Testament, you can see that Genesis was written as the last book, not the first one, even though it's the first book in the Old Testament. Well, there's a reason why. Well, Mr. Greenberg, he is the president of the Biblical Archaeological Society in New York. He even wrote that about that. He said that, you know, when Jews found out from the Babylonians about the importance of Armenia, they changed their mythology from the mountain around Egypt into the Mount Ararat. And that's the reason why you see it. There, a change took place. So they wanted to connect themselves to those mountains, and you can see it. It's reflected in Genesis already. So throughout the years, I mean, you can see how Armenian architecture and symbology was taken by Judaism. I mean, for example, look at the Star of David, it's called. The oldest hexagram was found in Armenia 6,000 years ago, used by the Armenians. They're still using it within architecture. So the Star of David is not really Star of David. It was a hexagram that was used by the Armenian Highlanders for a very long time. It was we can see a dagger, a part of a dagger which has the six angle star on a dagger, which was found in Armenia in Ashtarak. So you can see it in the architecture from 1200s, 1300s, all the way to 900 AD. At that time, they were not using it. So you can see all these misappropriation that's taking place throughout the years, and now you want to make sure that you own that. What are you going to do? Of course, you want to cut the ties from where you got the information from.
Right, yeah. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, do you have more to say about this?
Well, actually, I do a lot, and we have to take other things into consideration. I can give you another example of how misappropriation takes place. I mean, if you look at the Greek language and their Greek theology, for instance, you can see that their source of material was not Greek at all. They just took the information and then they added suffixes and prefixes on the words, changed the names of gods, for instance, and then they made it into their own, and they wanted to make sure they cut the ties of where they got that information from. You can see that. Let me give you an example. Let's look at the goddess Diana. If you read it backwards, it's Anahit. Anahit was the goddess of the Armenian people. It's still being, you know, considered and worshipped in some areas of Armenia right now. So same thing with Ra. For example, Ra was the Egyptian god. If you read it backwards, it's Ar. Look at Indra in India. If you read backwards, it's Ardhani. Ardhani was the sun god of the Armenian people. So you can see how the words have been changed and altered, you know, for them to inherit all this information. And same thing happened with Judaistic faith. I mean, they took all this, their information from Egyptian mythology, right? They took all their information and then they made it into their own monotheism.
Yeah, I mean, the syncretism there is just extraordinary, and the correlations. And I think, I mean, if we even think about it from the point of view that these were a people that were, you know, were in different parts at different times, and you know, in some cases they were enslaved, right? In some cases they invaded certain territories, etc. If they were nomadic by default, it would just make sense that they would pick up local traditions and everything, and that the formulation of their own mythology would occur later on as they could kind of, you know, coalesce it, and somehow, interestingly enough, it became the dominant one for a long time. That's interesting in itself.
Of course, it's through blood and sword. I mean, look at, let's say, the Sumerians. The Sumerians were there alone, and then the Akkadians come as nomads from the south. They settle in the north, and then let's say they become the servants of the Sumerians, and then all of a sudden Akkadians become part of their army, and then they take it over. And then, of course, the Akkadians give rise to the Assyrians, and then Assyrians give rise to the Babylonians and so forth. And then when, let's say, Jews migrate up there, or let's say if they're in captivity and so forth, you can see that how one theology and culture influences another. And you can see that through etymology alone, that all those words that are being used within certain nomadic group, it's not theirs at all. You can see that it was incorporated into their own. For example, let's take the word baklava. I'm sure you had baklava
sure,
before.
Sure, yeah, it's very good.
yeah, it's very good. Now, we have to look at how baklava is made. For you to make baklava, you cannot be a nomad. In other words, you have to make that for a very long time. You need to make sure that, you know, you have all the resources and so forth. So when you say baklava, let's say, is Turkish or Azerbaijani and so forth, it doesn't make any sense, because the etymology alone, baklava, comes from pahalvel. Pahalvel, it means to crumble. So once you look at that from that standpoint, you can see, okay, that it couldn't have been theirs. It must have been of people, you know, from elsewhere.
Interesting, yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the relations to Azerbaijan specifically. And I saw a couple of very inspiring images on your Facebook page. This was 91-year-old lady sitting there with an AK-47.
Yeah.
have the conflicts been going on for a long time between Azerbaijan and Armenia?
Yes, it's still going on. It's still going on. And there are a lot of infractions being made. Azerbaijani coming toward the Armenian side and threatening Armenia's future is very dim and so forth. You know, you have all these threats coming about from a country that is younger than Coca-Cola.
That's funny.
Yeah, if you look at it from that standpoint. I mean, you have all these threats going on, and that's their last resort, really. I mean, why threaten all these people who have been there for a very long time? In other words, that's their last resort. They can't do anything else. I mean, more and more people are learning about the Europeans and their history and so forth. So they can't lie. So no, they try to, you know, threaten with wars and so forth, historical falsifications, cultural genocide, you know, religious genocide and so forth. You know, a misappropriation of other matters. I mean, you have Azerbaijan taking Persian culture, making their own. We're not even talking about Armenian culture. We're talking about Persian culture too. You know, they're taking whatever is Persian and then making their own, pretending that it's theirs. And so the problem is the world audience needs to be more prepared with history and archaeology and language for them to determine that, okay, you know, if we know the truth, they can't falsify anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what it's all about, you know, getting in that, heading in that direction and really finding out and discovering in archaeology and everything, genetics and things like that, you know. But
sure.
And all of this happens in different tiers and you know, long-term strategies. There are very many different things that is happening right now in the world. I mean, I want to bring this into the fold as well. We have a huge problem, and I come to this primarily from the point of view, initially I did, from monotheism, right? The expansion of Christianity, a destruction of, you know, our culture and heritage in many of the European countries. Now we have a second wave of the Abrahamic virus coming in the form of Islam. I mean, there are regular riots in France, England, Holland, Sweden. Now, you know, there are huge problems with traitorous politicians. And frankly, a lot of Jewish activists that are advocating the dispossessions of Europeans from their own lands. We have Barbara Spector and Annette Kahn, and then you have founders like Kudenhof Kalergi, for example, of the pan-European movement that very much use the same language of trying to deconstruct the European peoples and everything else. How do you see Islam as a part of this process? I'm not trying to blame it on Muslims or Islam specifically. I think people misunderstand that as well. I'm seeing a geopolitical tactic right now to cause division within countries, to tear them apart. Order out of chaos or divide and conquer, this kind of relationship. And geopolitically, it's just turning into mayhem and chaos. And I can't view it in any other way that this is a plan by the elite to perform this. And I would suspect that I don't know how things are right now in Armenia, but are there any parallels as far as you're concerned, what is happening in Armenia that is happening in Europe as well about this question?
Well, my concern is this. I every day I see atrocities taking place in Europe, and beheadings and stoning and so forth. And I'm even surprised that even Europe is allowing all this to happen. Why would you allow, you know, desert nomads with their archaic book to come there and so forth? I mean, if they don't like it there, they can go back to where they came from.
That's right.
You know, yeah. But if we become, you know, more intellectually honest, you know, we can say that, you know, the books themselves give rise to the violence that's happening. In other words, you know, you can't say that it's a book of love and then all these beheadings are going forward. You know, that's not true. So, you know, there's a lot of influence, you know, from the books themselves that makes all this happen. So we can't really be ignorant on that part and say, well, you know, it's because of that person, I'm sure the others are okay. No, I mean, you have indoctrination. You know, they teach their children, you know, how to kill and how to stone and how to hate people. You know, you have to take into consideration. And same thing with Armenia, for instance. I mean, if you look at their websites of the proximate Islamic countries around the area, you know, you can see how they promote, you know, their faith. you know, pictures of, you know, genocides from Armenians, and, you know, with a crescent on the picture itself, and they have basically burning the flag, you know, burning the pictures of the martyrs who passed away during the genocide. And all this is perpetuated by, you know, I would say, you know, the Islamic faith from a general standpoint. I mean, I personally know a lot of Muslims who are very kind. But if you look at the books themselves, you know, it condones violence and so forth. So you can see where this atrocity comes forward. So my biggest fear in Armenia is basically where the geography is and how it is bombarded by all this violence and threat of violence, you know, from two Islamic countries in a country that has, you know, persevered for a very, very long time. And I think that the whole goal is for them to displace those people out of those lands, for them to own that land no more. That's basically it.
Well, I can't help to see it any other way, and it troubles me. But how can I not talk about what I'm seeing and witnessing right now? I mean, what's strange to me as well is that, you know, well, in the West we have abnormal and a completely unique and crippling political correctness that has been developed to destroy arguments, destroy free speech, and destroy any level of criticism and such, which is a tactic in itself, as we know. We've talked about that many times in the program, but I mean, if we look at what our value systems are in terms of the fact that we're basically not even allowed to touch our children. I mean, the child services might show up and take your child from you if they discover that you've, you know, done something to your child. And then we have, for example, well, to put this in context, let me just read a little bit from an article that we published on the website a while back called "Islam Creates Monsters," says psychologist. Mm-hmm. Danish psychologist Nikolai Senels, an expert in working with Muslim youth criminal offenders, has written a new book entitled "Among Criminal Muslims: A Psychologist Experience from the Copenhagen Municipality." And in an essay supporting the book, he claims that Islam creates monsters. A recent study out of Germany supports Senel's statement. It found that devout Muslims were more prone to violence than the non-Muslim participants in the study. Senel says that Islam is different from other religions because the way it is taught brainwashes its youth with violent messages. Parents inflict violence on their children repeatedly, Senel claims, and at the same time deliver religious ideology. He says this behavior makes Muslim extremists far more violent than extremists of other religious faiths. The brainwashing, as Senel terms it, begins very early on in a child's life, and religious messages are repeated vigorously along with a heavy dose of physical discipline. It is this combination of pain and reinforcement, Senel claims, that creates Islamic, quote, monsters, unquote, who then feels justified in torturing and killing innocent people. Senel points out that parents want to indoctrinate their children into the religion as early as possible so that these kids will remain Muslim instead of looking to another faith. Under Sharia law, turning against Islam is a crime punishable by death. So remember, guys, apostasy, we had the article up in a while back there, a woman who converted to Christianity. She was about to be stoned to death. She was pregnant and thrown in prison for it. And so this is a similar case here. Well, there's a danger here that if they, you know, drop Islam, or if they convert to another faith, you know, whatever that is, in the Western countries that they are in, they might actually be threatened. So the parents threatened with their life, right? So the parents are actually really scared about this, and they want to absolutely make sure the, you know, that the disciplinary methods of becoming a Muslim are strictly in force. Otherwise, the child's life might literally be in danger. So this is the parents' fear that's coming through here. So can you see how this actually creates problems now when you actually are co-mingling all these religious and non-religious faiths in the West, and then you have all these other issues, societal issues that's going on that just are complete culture clashes? That's what this is about. Anyway, he goes on to point out that Muslim culture lags far behind in the understanding of human development, and therefore the techniques that Western would call child abuse are deeply ingrained and normalized among Muslim parents as correct child-rearing strategies. Anyway, the article goes on from there, but I'll link it up instead. I'm not going to read it all here. But okay, so you might be saying, sure, it's just one man's opinion, but the fact is that this, I mean, this is something that has happened within the culture because of the religious, you know, fervor that exists within it. I mean, just look at, for example, they in their calendar, then the 14 1400s, 1500s right now. If we look back to Christian times of expansion, when they were in their 1400s and 1500s, we have terrible issues with, you know, the Jesuit order, for example, and the way
crusades,
that they crusades and everything. Exactly. So I'm just, people have to forget about your political correctness garbage and, you know, and just think about this for a minute and think about it. This has happened in every major religion. It has been this kind of incentive within it. It has been a specific phase that has been about domination and, you know, taking over and everything else. So my point here, anyway, to make a long-winded argument fairly shorter, it's I don't understand how we can not see this, how we're so blinded by the fact that, yes, there are issues and problems within religion. It's not, I mean, Islam is not a race, it's a religion. No, anybody can have this. It's not about being a racist or targeting someone specifically, you know? Yep. So this clash, this culture clash that's going on right now in terms of this is something that I'm basically seeing. Again, I can't see that it has any other objective than to bring a kind of a chaos to the street level so that our dear good old elite globalists can offer the solution to bring security and safety to us once more. And people for some reason are not seeing through this and seeing it, how it's being used as a political tool to enforce, you know, certain behaviors within not only Europe, this is in other countries as well, as we said. But it's I just don't see the disconnect. Is this something you're surprised by?
Well, no. I mean, Sam Harris, the neuroscientist, you know, he said that religious moderation gives cover to religious extremism.
Right.
And he was right, because when we say we're blind to this, we are blind because we're, in a way, most people are religious moderates, and they say, oh, well, you know, it's not because of religion, it's because of other factors. No, it's not. If you really read the books themselves, they basically tell you how to kill people, you know, how to stone people and how to make people slaves and how to treat women and so forth. It's all archaic Bronze Age, archaic stuff. And you can't but help noticing all this. And my thing is that, okay, what are you going to do, let's say, if you're awake? If humanity has woken up from this coma, what are they going to do? Well, the thing is that Europe has their open doors to all this venom that comes in. So they're going to expect all this to happen. I'm not sure what immigration laws they have, but these people are flocking their lands to come to Europe to continue doing what they were doing there.
Yeah.
And then they get mad because the society doesn't allow it. And my biggest question is, how does the elite allow this to happen? Are they being bought? I'm sure they have a lot of money there. You know, they can buy the politicians in Europe. Is that it? In other words, is that the problem? Because I don't see any other way. I mean, if you know that somebody is sick, or you know the source of your sickness, you know, you want to make sure that you get well. So I'm not sure if Europe is seeing the source, why can't they do anything, unless there is a bigger undercurrent where they allow this to happen because of monetary reasons, because of financial reasons. I don't see any other way.
There are rumors. I haven't confirmed this yet either. I have to look into it further, but I've heard rumors of allegedly individual politicians being bribed by money coming their way to actually be far more lenient on the border issues and asylum issues than other people would be if they didn't receive that money, shall we say. And that's very possible. But then at the same time, then you have another angle to the conflict, which is, of course, people like Barbara Spector, who gets state money in Sweden as the Jewish Learning Center, Paideia in Stockholm, where she openly talks about how Europe has to become multicultural, and this is her words, that Jews will be hated for our role in basically breaking down Europe, you know, ethnicities in Europe. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, it's like, really? Okay. So you've agreed with all the Jewish people that this is the plan? I mean, that's interesting. When did you have this meeting, first of all? And second of all, how can you speak for everyone? And then third, why are people not seeing that this is an issue then? And again, I guess the reason why I bring it up is because I go back to that statement I made before. I think it's a relationship here between potentially Armenia and Europe as well, that there is an ethnic conflict that goes back thousands of years, if we just basically are witnessing the continuation of this. And I know that that might be difficult for people to see or understand, but the fact is that there are people in our world who have long-term plans, and they're not just thinking about, you know, going to the ice cream shop and then don't know what to do the rest of their day. You know, they actually think hundreds of years forward. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. And I could relate to that when it comes to Armenia. I mean, you had seen so many atrocities throughout the years and throughout hundreds of years when, Islam was at whereabouts in Armenia and all the atrocities that took place. So it's not really something recent. I mean, you were referring to, let's say, the conflict between Indo-Europeans and Semites, for instance. But when we say Semite, then we have to consider the Arabs, we have to consider the Assyrians. So it's not really a Jewish thing. I mean, anti-Semitism, I think it's just an invented word. You know, you have to consider. Yeah. You have to consider the Arabs. What about the Assyrians? Assyrians have been around much longer than the Jews themselves. Jewish history doesn't go back further than 1000 BC. Even that is a stretch. So, you know, that already proves that all the Bible myths about them, it's not really about them. It's just anachronistic. You know, calling Abraham, let's say, the first Jew, for instance, that's just a fairy tale. And even, you know, Neil Silberman, you know, from the Hebrew University in the Bible on Earth, they proved that whatever you have in the Old Testament is not history, it's just stories, basically.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm sure you read that book. So in other words, we have to reconcile now, which is irreconcilable, of all the mythology that has been immersed in the human mind for the last 2,500 years, and we're trying to reconcile that with actually history, with what we have when it comes to evidence and science and so forth. So I think that's the friction right there. You know, the Islamic books say about their domination of the world, and it's understandable. It's written in there.
Right.
We're not inventing this. So it's the same thing. For example, the Napoleon Hill, when he wrote Think and Grow Rich, if you read that book, he said, you know, whatever the mind conceives, for example, you know, it can achieve. So if you're going to say to yourself for hundreds of years that you are going to dominate the world and you're going to have all these people to think that way, they're going to materialize that idea.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's a meme that has been dropped into it. And again, if you have a tie between your whole identity as a being and then a religious text upon that, you know, that is going to influence you. I mean, it's like religion has been one of the most powerful mind control mechanisms that there is. And then people might think of themselves as being beyond these concepts, right? They say, oh, I don't care about religion or, you know, culture or heritage, anything like this. Well, that doesn't mean that there aren't other people in the world that do that and consequently follow suit and actually are either consciously or subconsciously fulfilling those desires that they've been mind controlled with, you know?
Absolutely. And you can see that. I mean, it's very simple. I mean, you have seen all these atrocities that took place. A religion, especially monotheism, Abrahamic monotheism, just doesn't come into a society through just very easily. You know, you have to have some blood and sword and devastation and murder for it to take place, because the book themselves are just, in other words, anti-human. You know, it doesn't matter how you decipher it, whether you use parables, whether you use similes or, you know, metaphors and so forth. You know, it tells you specifically, it gives you directives how to inflict, you know, chaos in the society. That's all.
So it just dawned on me here, the way potentially we should view this is basically that if we are intellectually and historically honest, as you mentioned before, and we can view history in this objective manner, that we know, yes, there has been expansions due to religion in the past. We can see, for example, that European societies have changed and developed according to the invasion of Christianity, which is a fundamental part in the Abrahamic, religions concept. Mm-hmm. What we're getting now is the third or second, depending on how you see it, but the next wave in this mind control programming, basically. And this is going to occur. History is going to repeat itself if we do not do anything about it. And violence once more, and this convert or you'll die kind of attitude potentially might once again actually reach Europe and many other parts of the world, as it has, Armenia included as well, if we don't speak up and do anything about this.
Absolutely. I agree. There is no stop to it if you don't put a stop to it. It's very important to realize that it's the children that are exposed to this violence. In other words, they are indoctrinated into when they grow up, they're going to continue what their father has done. And it's all through indoctrination of the books and the hate that is being contributed to the mind of the child. You know, I'm an organizational psychologist. I have been around in clinics in my rounds, and I have seen people, you know, who think this way, and that's their reality, and they don't know any better. I mean, an insane person doesn't know he's insane. So, you know, if they're indoctrinated into a certain mindset, they don't know any better. You know, they are going to continue doing it that way. That's why you are going to see beheadings. You are going to see a father doing an honor killing of the daughter because, you know, she slept with another man and so forth. You are going to see it because they think that way because their books say that way. That's basically it. There is no other way. You know, we have to come to terms that those books tell people how to behave. And if they're going to do this expansionary migration into Europe, for instance, and destroy the culture there, it is going to happen unless people stop it. You know, there is no stop to it if you're going to just say, oh, it's okay, never mind. You know, it's just only a few people here and there. But no, look at France. I mean, the middle of the day, you know, you have thousands of people worshiping, for instance. That's understandable. But, you know, it's completely disruptive. You know, it's not a norm. And I mean, I don't want to say France. I don't think France or Paris is a European city anymore.
Well, London too. I think the majority of white London Britons moved out. I think it's been over 600,000 white Britons leaving London in the last 10 years. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a disaster. I'm telling you. I mean, Armenia's seeing the same thing. I mean, it has economic problems there, and they flee the country. They go elsewhere. So all this assimilation is going on, and then a country is being depleted. So of course you have a void. So you have other groups coming in to fill the void. It's happening.
Oh my God! I can't believe that people are not seeing this. I mean, sure, there's some that haven't been to Europe. They're not. They might be out on the countryside. They don't see it. They don't keep up with this kind of news, etc. Mm-hmm. But it's like that, because on top of this, then we do have a lot of naive liberals in Europe that continue to deny this, of course, because they have a. They have a pipe dream of a, you know, the rainbow diversity, but it turns out, you know, that it creates more problems and issues that it resolves, and they continue to deny this despite. Mm-hmm. See, it's not about the studies or about the information or the statistics of what you can show, or even like just demonstrating by showing videos.
Right, it's not evidence.
You know, no, exactly. It's an ideological one. They are in themselves religiously programmed in a sense. They just don't know it. You know, by accepting all this.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So how do you think that we should go about here in terms of reconnecting to our ancient, you know, common traditions, both Armenian and European, trying to realize what is happening in the world at this stage and how to, you know, prevent violence and prevent, you know, further warfare and being able to live in our respective countries in a peaceful manner and have, you know, visitor and have guests and have cultural exchanges and having preserving the cultures that we have and instead valuing those and trading with each other and visiting each other and appreciating it from this perspective, as opposed to turning into this kind of weird morph between, you know, violence and religious monoculture. I don't know what to call it, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can say it from my experience. I think it will explain it all. For example, through intellectually honest research, I was able to, from my standpoint, save ancient history of my people from it being diminished, which means that, of course, it saves other Indo-European languages. It drives the initiative for other people to also look after their, you know, ancestors and about their culture and their ancestry and so forth. As you can see, there's a positive side to it. You know, the more we're open to our ancient history, the more we can realize how much has been destroyed and how much we can save and how we can persevere all that and preserve all that. And I think that just by doing that, it will yield to inter-country collaboration, more respect toward one another. You know, if we see that we are genetically linked, let's say the Celts and the Armenians and the Welsh and the British and German, you know, they can see this and they can appreciate each other more because they go back further back in time.
Yeah.
And at the same time, by doing that, they can become much stronger and look at all the threat, you know, from different perspectives. You know, how, what to do to come together to save a culture or save the nation or the plethora of nations that are being under threat right now from those people who don't care about culture and ancestry.
Exactly.
They just care about imaginary friends and, you know, up in the sky and then hell and heaven and so forth. You know, how do we save even their children from indoctrination? And so, yeah, that's basically, that's the thing. I want to take away this by saying that, you know, we are really saving everybody's history and culture and heritage by really understanding our own, to be more open-minded, you know, not, you know, our history didn't start from Christianity. You know, we were there a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
And Christianity is only 1%, maybe 10% of our entire history. So why not embrace all that?
Well, exactly. And just the idea that you mentioned before that nations is not a geographical imaginary line on the, you know, on the map. It's a people, it's a culture, it's the traditions, it's everything that has been developing and changing and morphing through the thousands of years in adaptation mm-hmm. To the geography and to things that are, you know, occur within the cycles of nature in the local area where you're at. All of these things, it's beautiful. It's wonderful to have this, you know, and to see this being threatened in the way that it is. It's just it really burdens me. I see no other issue that is more important because of the fact that we will lose ourselves. I mean, we'll become prey to the wet dream of the globalist elite. That's how I see it. Because when we become rootless and we sever the connection to our ancestors and to our past, we literally become pawns in the game, and we will not have any firm grounding or footing in anything that actually matters or anything like that. And we think that, again, I encounter a lot of these people that think that, oh, well, I'm beyond all that. You know, I'm it's a kind of a hyper individuality that they somehow are isolated in the universe and they're not part of anything, you know, and it scares me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The ignorance, the negligence of all this is going to be much even worse. And those perpetrators know that, you know, the more persistent they are, and the more people get scared of them, you know, the more they will continue doing their deeds. That's basically it. You know, if they're going to allow themselves to understand, you know, human history, they would walk away from all the monstrosity that contains in their books, but they're not allowing themselves because they're children. Their children is key. Our children are key. They need to be free to think, to understand, to, you know, to love one another, and it's not being done, so they're barred from it. That's the reason.
Yeah, very good. Now, a couple of more points and questions here before we begin to round things up. But this time, how do you see this playing out then in the future? I guess this is a two-part question in a way. One is, of course, the point of view of Armenia in itself, and if there's any risks here in terms of something similar that has happened already historically repeating itself. And I guess the other part of this is the bigger picture of, again, I know you're not maybe per se geopolitics, but from the point of view of history and culture and tradition and everything else, if we don't stop this, how do you think things will play out? What will happen?
Well, I can start by saying that, for instance, let's say the churches themselves. Let's say the churches that were built before the genocide that lies around Turkey and Georgia and Azerbaijan, for instance. Those churches are either being destroyed or made into a mosque, or they're turned into a barn. So you can see a small example of how ancient culture is being devastated by those who don't care about that anymore. I mean, if you found in Sweden, let's say, a 50,000-year-old artifact, would you destroy it? Of course not.
No.
You know, you want to preserve it. But they don't think that way because they don't have any culture or heritage. They don't know what it means. They have inherited culture and heritage. Their ancestors didn't know anything about culture and heritage and civilization at all. So whatever we see, whatever we ache about, they don't see it. They don't conceptualize what it means to destroy ancient civilization and culture. I mean, you in Egypt, you know, the fundamentalists, they wanted to destroy the pyramids because it went against their faith. You know, what the hell is that? You know, so you can see that they don't see the same thing as we do For people who are cognizant and have memory of their ancestral, you know, migrations and their deeds and so forth.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very good example to see what will happen if you are surrounded with people like that, or if people like that are already within your borders. So it's basically this what's going to happen. They are going to destroy what they don't understand. And they're not going to understand because their ancestors don't have the culture and heritage that we do.
Very good said. Very well said. So what is next for you here in terms of research and development? I, for example, saw that a step pyramid recently was found in Armenia. That's pretty cool. Are you into archaeological finds now as well? Are you going to try to dig some of this together?
Oh, yes. Actually, if I wish that there was more funds that could be appropriated to excavations and archaeological research in Armenia, because you know, with small funds, a few years ago, they found the oldest winery and the oldest shoe that was found in Areni in Armenia. So if you can imagine, if there are more funds appropriated, you know, what we can find under there, and I'm thinking of even following the footsteps of Vahan Sarkisian, who was a Basqueologist who did research with the Spanish and Basque Institute, Language Institute, and to make basically follow his footsteps to make the Basque and Armenian language to be more prevalent and for them to understand the connections between the two.
Interesting. How is the archaeological field, by the way, in Armenia? Is it a lot of dedication? I mean, is the country relatively poor? Is there a lot of funds appropriated for this kind of stuff? Or?
No, the funds are not being appropriated enough. I don't think the country is poor. It has a lot of people who are wealthy. It's just that, you know, this idea needs to be promoted. In other words, you know, you are standing there as one of the oldest centers in the world, I would say, and why not go underneath and find all this and build, for example, the biggest museum so people can come and see and so forth. So I think that it's a good idea, and more people are waking up from this coma, just like, you know, Europeans do now.
Yeah,
they're basically having open arms to their ancient history, ancient culture, and more Armenian people are waking up from their own coma for the last 1700 years that have been in there. So more and more people are going back to their roots. We have a lot of people now going back to their Mithraic, you know, religion, astrotheology. So I think that's a good start, because more and more people will wonder what lies underneath, you know, the ground underneath the church and so forth. So they need to wake up. Everybody needs to wake up.
Wonderful. Well, yeah, exactly. Let's move ahead from this, what we have right now, and, you know, reach for the light and find the next level to things and solve some of these issues, because it's definitely one of the big questions of our time. So, well, this
Indeed.
Has been wonderful having you here, Vahan. Truly enriching, I should say. It's been an exchange of ideas and realizations and insight into culture and history and tradition, as opposed to the fake enrichments that we're getting with
Indeed.
Monoculture.
You know? So, Indeed.
Good
Indeed.
Stuff. Give Indeed. Us all the details again, where people can find you, get your books, give us the titles, etc.
Thank you very much. One of the books was published back in 2012. It's called The Enigma of the Armenian Alphabet. It can be found on Amazon.com and Lulu.com. And the forthcoming book will be released July 4th. And it's called Language as a Fingerprint. And currently it is on pre-order. You can get that through thearmenian.com. And eventually I'll give more details when it comes to that book. And my Facebook page is called Historicity of the Armenian People, from Neolithic times to the present. I have a lot of articles there when it comes to science and research and Indo-European history. Thank you.
Very good. We'll have these links up on the website. Thanks again, Vahan. Keep up the good work, and I hope we can touch base soon again and have you back and talk more about all these things.
I hope so too. Thank you so much. You've been very kind. Appreciate it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you've learned something new. We have much more coming. Joseph Atwill is next on the program to talk about the true identity of Shakespeare and the works compiled as a revenge for the Gospels, a typology reversal. We'll get into what the bigger picture is here as well. Later, we have John Rappaport, Felice Vinci with William Mullen, Carol Rosen, and many more. Thank you so much for your membership and for your continued support. We'll be back on Friday with more. Until then, we say thank you for listening. Keep up your spirit, reach for the light, and remember, the more we are challenged and tried, the better we become. and the more urgently it becomes that we reach for new heights. All right, we'll speak to you soon. Have a good day. Bye-bye.